In our last episode, we talked to Kimberly Zhang, CEO and co-founder of Roomy Spice, a mountaineer, a marathoner, an army officer, and a graduate of West Point. She once wrote, quote, "My mother brought me up strictly Southern Baptist with my eyes set on Stanford. So when I went to West Point, it was a way out, my kind of rebellion," end quote. But this teenage rebel soon met her toughest match.
At West Point, they break you down all the way. They yell at you. You are the worst. And they build you back up to become a leader.
Leading 40 soldiers as a platoon leader in Afghanistan, Kimberly's job could turn deadly any moment, any day.
And you're blowing up stuff, like IEDs and roadside bombs, and you're repelling assaults.
Fearing landmines could be deadly, but facing taunting at Harvard Business School could feel like a slap in the face.
Yeah, one guy was like telling all of us like how he didn't like Goldman Sachs, but he was able to like already get an offer from BCG without even interviewing because he'd done so well. Some of my classmates, they're like, "Oh, Kim, like, what are you gonna do?" And I was like, "I went to Afghanistan and I started Roomy Spice." I'm like, "Oh, that's not too bad. It's just import-export at the end of the day, right? Just saffron." And people are like, "Oh, that's a cute project." This is never gonna work. Like, you're crazy to think that you can start a business in Afghanistan. Like, you're too idealistic.
Indeed. Kimberly Zhang is idealistic and realistic. In this episode, Keep Climbing, we focus on rejection and risks, setbacks and struggles after Kimberly began her life at West Point. And of course, there would also be big surprises when she dived into Shark Tank on CNBC.
Next into the tank are veterans hoping to help farmers in a war-torn country by capitalizing on a rare commodity.
Hi, Sharks. I'm Kim.
I'm Emily.
And I'm Keith.
We are Roomy Spice.
Sharks, today we are seeking $250,000 in investment in exchange for 5% of our company.
One after another, the sharks would bite and exit.
The product is just too expensive for the everyday person. And for that reason, I'm out.
I personally don't like saffron, so I'm out.
I gotta tell you, Kim, for a couple of Harvard grads, I'm a little surprised you don't have your model nailed down even more.
They do.
Well, wait, look, Kim,
no, they don't.
Let me ask
no,
you
they
this.
Don't.
Yes, we are Harvard grads, but we're not perfect. I mean, I was just a Harvard grad last year, right? Most of my education has been what we've been doing this last year. Yeah. You guys are the ones who know this stuff. This is why we're here.
You come in, you're not in Afghanistan. You're in the Shark Tank now. You have to know your numbers.
They do know their numbers.
No, they don't.
I'm Abel Chan, and this is One in a Billion, a podcast about Chinese millennials in America.
Okay, guys, I think your mission is good. I think it's going to be impactful beyond just your product. I've invested a lot of military-based companies. So I'm going to offer you the $250K for 15%.
That's Mark Cuban on Shark Tank, giving Kim an offer that is much lower than what she's asked for.
And that's non-negotiable. Don't even think about a counter, because this is the number or not.
Kim, I'll make it really easy. My offer was going to be $250,000 for 25%. What are you going to do?
What would Kim do? She couldn't negotiate. During our studio interview, Kimberly was not allowed to talk about her appearance on Shark Tank until after it aired in May. Although we did not discuss her thought process on the show, we'll let you know what she decided just a little bit later. But first, why would Kimberly choose West Point, an elite military academy, over an Ivy League education, defying her mother's expectation?
The one thing I was supposed to do in my entire life was to get into Harvard or Stanford or MIT and become a doctor, a lawyer, or, you know, something very, like, highly regarded in the Asian community. I had a very high GPA and I did a lot of community service. I was not allowed to get A minuses.
But Kimberly does not have a tiger mom.
You know, my mom didn't have to tell me to do my homework. I like to do my homework because I like to get things done and I liked getting good grades. I had this imbued in me from the very beginning. I think I've just always been very achievement-oriented. The deviation happened when instead of going to Harvard, Stanford, or, you know, Caltech, I decided to go to West Point.
Why?
my little sister's older, her one of her friend's older brother went to a place called West Point. I remember somebody talking about it. It might have been my father or my mother or someone else and saying, oh, West Point, that's an institution. It's very, very hard to get into and it's very grueling. And when people graduate from there, they become officers in the United States Army and they go into war and they lead platoons. And when I heard that, of course, I was just like, I have to go there.
So it came from family chatter, and that was it. That was enough to spark her imagination. Remember, Kimberly had always been an A student on scholarship. As a teen, her community service and her exposure to athletic challenges like taekwondo, aviation camps, space camp, volleyball, and soccer camps, all of that made her a perfect fit for West Point. But Kim is just one of 148 women, one of 69 Asians to graduate from West Point out of a class of 972 cadets in 2008. Before West Point, Kim actually thought about becoming an astronaut. I couldn't help but wonder, aren't these ambitions rather masculine?
I'm very careful about saying what's feminine or masculine because we as human beings are kind of conditioned to separate the feminine and masculine spheres and to already define what those are. And I've met plenty of women who are very feminine who want to do these things. And the same thing with men and boys. Like, I don't understand why, let's say, wanting to cook or do clothes is a feminine thing. It's not. It doesn't have to be.
It doesn't have to be. And you're right about that. And I think I'm sensitive to our upbringing, you know, in a conservative Chinese culture.
And actually, that's funny because my parents are very conservative. And my mom still tells me, like, I have to marry somebody and then I'm the one staying at home. And it's like, no, what are you kidding me? Like, after all that you've, like, you know, given to me to my upbringing and told me to, like, succeed, it's also that I can attract, like, a doctor or a lawyer so
no
that
way.
I can... No,
she's
yeah,
still
no.
Saying that, not anymore.
She still says it. She does. She still believes that stuff.
And then, okay, so therefore, how did you convince them West Point is right for you? How did you overcome that? How did you turn them around to support you? Did they support you?
In the beginning, they didn't. And it was mostly my dad. And he said, are you sure you want to do this? Because I don't think you fully understand what it means to go to the Army and to go to war because you're signing up your life to serve the country.
Yeah, but when they were asking you to think deeper, raising doubts about what you were thinking, were you giving a second thought? Did you ask yourself, why am I so gung-ho about serving this country? What is it about that 16, 17-year-old Kimberly?
What really attracted me to this, and I think has been a theme in my whole life, is wanting to be part of something bigger than oneself. I've always liked to work really hard and to do something that matters.
Kimberly's parents would let their teenage daughter go find her way.
I've always loved adventure, and I've always wanted to put myself in the, you know, in the fire to see, like, how things turn out. So that's perhaps why I did well in school, because I like test taking and I like to succeed and overcome. But of course, as you do that, you always face a lot of failure too. So, you know, my whole life has not been without tons and tons of failure.
At West Point, she was picked on.
In the beginning, I was very much, I had this reputation at West Point for being very smart, but having no common sense. And I got hazed really bad.
And yelled at.
What do you mean, no common sense?
Oh, I had no common sense. I mean, I just made these, like, you know, ridiculous errors. I get very flustered when people yelled at me. And, you know, of course, like, they do
well,
that
on purpose.
You're
18 or 19.
Yeah, and a lot of other people did too. It's good, though, because that really teaches you just by rote, like, just doing it over and over again, like, how to overcome it.
What were the toughest parts for you?
Definitely the first summer, which is called Beast Barracks. You're walking around and you have to do, I think it's like 70 steps per minute.
You have to cup your hands a certain way and you have to look
forward.
You
have to greet all your upperclassmen a certain way, depending on their rank.
You have to memorize all the meals for the next 3 days.
Regurgitate them when people ask you what the meals are going to be.
That's a ton of drills, making soldiers obey. And here's one time that Kimberly broke down and cried.
I was doing land navigation because I was a varsity team member, I didn't do any of the training that I was supposed to do for land navigation. So it was an epic fail. Like, I was lost in the woods.
That was a test. Kimberly was supposed to go run around in the woods, jot down a number on a tree, and return the report to the officer in charge, all before time's up.
I was lost in the woods. I actually ended up running back, and I made it just in time, but I forgot to write down the tree number that I was in. I was like, oh, I'll just write this down now. He's like, no, the time is up. You're 1 minute past, and you don't have the number on the tree written down. You failed. And I just remember crying, and being like, but I made it, and I ran all the way back. Mission was not accomplished to standard. And I had to repeat that day. And not only that, I failed night land nav too.
But the next day?
And like the day after, I'm like, well, I can't believe I cried. You know, like at some point it was like, you sit down and you're just like, well, this is kind of funny. You know, you're not going to die.
How did you become stronger? In what way? Mentally, physically? Can you describe a little bit about that through that training?
Well, you know, you do a lot of platoon runs and push-ups and pull-ups and carrying a lot of heavy stuff. And how do you become stronger? You just, like, you have to do it. So you just feel your body become stronger. And it does. And you want to do well in the physical fitness test. You have the attitude of, like, just do it or don't do it.
In hindsight, what were the skills? What were the points of all of this? And what were the skills you've gained?
It's to not take it personally, and to be really good at, like, taking failure, because failure seems such like it's such a word that is so negative, but really this is how I would view all of this is it's not about you. You know, it's about what you can do, and you're just a vessel to become what you need to become. So therefore you're just learning. So cut yourself some slack. You know, if you're enrolling in an institution like West Point, trust that they will teach you how to become a good officer, and they'll teach you all the necessary skills. Like, you're just another vessel also. And you do your best. And it's not personal, and it's not your ego. It's not about you.
While serving as a platoon leader on a combat mission in Afghanistan, she was sensitive to local attitudes towards women.
Even though I cut my hair short, I mean, I'm a woman. So some of my Afghan counterparts or some people that we would talk to as we were doing our missions, like in the villages or out in the fields, even if I approached them, they would not talk to me. They would not look at me. So they had to talk to my platoon leader or my platoon sergeant.
But Kimberly was still in charge of her team. One time during a route clearance mission, gunshots rang out. She led her platoon to track down the gunman. Was it one? Were there more? She would be on the spot to make a tough call.
We ended up surrounding this compound, and then we actually went on to the rooftop to find these guys, and all the expended rounds were there. We were about ready to enter into that building, and we knocked on the door, bang, 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 and this lady came out, and she had this dog, and this dog was snarling, and was really, you know, because of course, like, he thinks of us as, like, intruders. And she kept telling us, there's nobody here, there's nobody here. And of course, like, the people who were shooting at us were in there. And I know a lot of people in my platoon were like, let's go in there, let's go, like, let's go F some shit up or something like that. I mean, at that point, it was on me to make that decision if we were gonna go in there or not.
She decided to stay on mission.
And I wasn't sure necessarily that it'd be safe to go in. Mm-hmm. And it was necessarily part of our mission. Because we were supposed to be clearing roads. What would be accomplished out of this? Like, okay, we maybe get some bad guys, but we also are not necessarily trained to, like, do, like, search and, like, you know, get into a home and do room searching and stuff. What if things were rigged? So I decided at that point, we're not going in. I was 23, 24 years old, making a life and death decision for 40 people.
From what I hear, it sounds like in your Army training and in combat, it's very mission driven. But also, the Army discipline drills in your head of obeying and following the rules. That sounds counterintuitive to me, looking at you now being a very entrepreneurial and innovative thinker. Do you see any odds in that in your training in the military and who you are now?
No, I think the Army is one of the most entrepreneurial organizations out there. What the Army does is it figures out a problem. So it has a way of solving problems and it has a way of bringing resources into where it's needed most and having teams talk about it in a very non-ego way, where it's like, where is the best place to deploy these resources? How can we put these things together to make it work? And so the military is actually extremely entrepreneurial, in my opinion.
So in a nutshell, what would you say are sort of the top three, you know, characteristics of this military-trained mindset that you carry with you to become entrepreneur?
So number one is a dedication to the mission, to get it done. Number two is the realization that anything really is possible, which means that when times get tough, there is always a way out. And you need your team to do that. That last one, I'm going to talk a little bit about leadership, which is getting people to see the vision of what needs to happen and for them to get them to like be inspired by it and to be committed to it.
But in a war zone, anything can happen, including a marriage proposal.
And then I remember we were doing like a biometrics mission and we were sitting there for a while. And so one of the men in the village came up to me and he spoke very good English. And he was telling me, why are you here? You have all your equipment on and you've come to our village and we could welcome you in, but you have all these guns and why are you doing this? I have a brother. He's not married. You could take off all of this gear and you could come marry my brother and be part of our family.
What?
It sounds crazy, but at the same time, like what he was doing was a gesture of hospitality. Mm. You know, saying you could become one of us. But I told him, I said, this is my family. These are my brothers and my sisters. I can't just leave them.
I was just stunned when I first heard this story. The Afghan people wanted Kimberly to be part of their family?
And I totally got it. And that's actually what really affected my viewpoint of Afghanistan afterwards and what got me to start Rumi Spice to begin with.
2 years ago, Kimberly gave a public talk about her entrepreneurial journey. She said it actually began not with a bang, but with a bust.
I went to business school where they ask you, what will you do with your one wild and precious life? And so my first thought was I'm going to go to McKinsey and I'm going to San Francisco and be a consultant. And I didn't get the job, and I was very devastated at the time.
But Kimberly would not sit still to feel like a victim. She got on the phone with her army buddy, Keith.
He was telling me about this farmer named Haji Yosef. Now, Haji Yosef is amazing. He's an entrepreneur himself. He's a farmer, and he was growing saffron in the Wardak province, which is the same province where I was a route clearance platoon leader a couple of years back. Now, Haji Yosef went to these aid organizations to try to get business opportunities from them, because that's what they promised him. And he came back with a lot of promises, and none of them were fulfilled.
Kimberly saw a problem and an opportunity. It would be back to Afghanistan. There was unfinished business waiting for her.
And I remember thinking to myself, this guy's so entrepreneurial. Like, he's just got nowhere to sell to, but this problem can be solved because this is some of the best saffron in the world.
Kimberly recalled that business school question again.
What will you do with your one wild and precious life, because you only have one wild and precious life.
That line was lifted from Mary Oliver's poem, The Summer Day.
Decided we're going to start this business. I remember there was a quote from Rumi, out beyond fields of wrongdoing and rightdoing, there's a field. There's so many things out there that needs to be done, and it's not necessarily right or wrong, but the question is, are you going to do it? Or are you not going to do it? Mm-hmm. And of course, I jumped right into it. So I bought myself a ticket to Afghanistan. My entrepreneurship professor at HBS wanted to go with me.
That summer, 2014, Kimberly met up with Haji, the saffron farmer that her army buddy Keith told her about. Haji refused to shake her hands at first, but soon they bonded. They started building a business together, and her company began importing saffron in Boston.
And today, we hired 384 Afghan women in our three processing facilities, 94 farmers we partnered with. We were 3.6% of Afghanistan's total foreign direct investment in agriculture, 5% of Afghanistan's total saffron export. And now these farmers are not just shaking my hand, they're taking selfies with me. Like, we're making some big impact in Afghanistan. We've already inserted $500,000 worth of into the economy in Afghanistan.
You made it sound too easy. Stop, stop, stop. It's too easy. You cannot suddenly succeed so quickly. I gotta know, what were the challenges from day one? What was the number one step? And what made it hard?
Oh, everything was so hard. This is one of the hardest things I've ever done in my life.
So what was step number one that you decided to do in terms of marketing, in terms of finding distributor, people want to buy from you and invest in you? Break that down for us.
You know, from a business perspective, you have to figure out what the market size is, who's going to buy from you, what are the price points, what are the margins in this business. And we had limited information, but I decided it's still worth a try.
Right. So my question is, why did you believe in it? What is the value that you see, and how did you share that message?
Well, there are a few people who did believe. In the beginning, Emily didn't. So she's one of the first female members of Special Forces and did night raids in Afghanistan. In the beginning, she's like, Kim, I'm so sorry. I'm in love with what you're doing, but it's just never going to work. So she didn't join me for the summer.
By the end of the summer, after Kim had gone to Afghanistan, come back, and started selling saffron,
she's like, I was wrong. I don't care that, you know, that it still might not happen. The fact that you're doing it is inspiring, and the fact that it is possible. You're right, it's possible. I'm joining you. Yeah, and so it almost just takes one person to just take that step. And it's not even, at that point, we hadn't really demonstrated anything.
I think the hardest thing at the beginning is to get people to believe. How hard was it to get local farmers, outside investors, distributors to believe in the value of your business idea?
That is very hard. So again, what is that? That's leadership, because I describe leadership as getting people to believe their value proposition and your value proposition. So every leadership is negotiation at the end of the day. Yeah. Whether you're fundraising, whether you're a boss, whether you're starting a business, or whether you're a platoon leader, you know, so this is all about negotiation.
Negotiation. That brings us back to Shark Tank.
Kim, why is it so expensive?
It's so expensive because there's no automation. It all has to be hand processed.
It's insanely labor intensive. It takes 150 hours of labor just to produce 1 gram of saffron.
As we mentioned at the top of this episode, she and her team were seeking investment from the sharks. Their negotiation was downright intense.
So tell us about the sales of saffron in the United States.
In the United States, it's a little over 60 million, so it's not big.
Well, how do you compare it to another spice?
We're not really in the spice industry here. We're talking about building a brand around saffron and doing other saffron-related products.
So you want to turn this into a brand?
Right.
Mm-hmm. One, how are you going to turn it into a brand? And two, who's your primary customer going to be? What do you see as your biggest political risk?
I don't think there's a political risk because we're operating with the farmers. We're giving them incentive to produce.
That's it. Economic empowerment. With that mission, she convinced two sharks with two different offers.
Kim, I'll make it really easy.
That's Robert Herjavec.
My offer was going to be $250,000 for 25%.
Okay, guys.
That's Mark Cuban.
I think your mission is good. I think it's going to be impactful beyond just your product. I've invested a lot of military-based companies. So I'm going to offer you the $250,000 for 15%. And that's non-negotiable.
What are you gonna do?
In less than 10 seconds, Kimberly made up her mind.
Mark, we'd like to accept your offer.
That's what I'm talking about!
Thank you.
What really attracted me to this, and I think has been a theme in my whole life, is wanting to be part of something bigger than oneself.
You know, as a person, as a woman, as an entrepreneur, what makes you proud?
What makes me proud is being able to really make a change in the world. And so what I'm really proud of and what I view success is being able to see what can be done. So that's, again, negotiation. To see the value that can be created and then bring people to the negotiating table and brainstorm together and work together. It's about empowering people to do great things beyond what they're even expecting themselves to do is getting them to give up something of themselves towards this cause. That's what success is.
Well done, Kimberly. Now, we want to hear from you. Send us your comments, pitch us a story. Just go to our new website, oneinabillionvoices.org, and find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. In our next episode,
How do you overcome your past as an abandoned girl in China to become a rising star in the world of education and entertainment in America? That is Kira Ullman's story. Stay tuned for our next episode. What in a Billion is
Pallavi Kuthamasu,
Eric Liao,
Brian Latwinowicz,
Sarah Zhu.
It is an independent production of One in a Billion Productions, a nonprofit educational media group in Kendall Square, Cambridge, Massachusetts.